It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You've probably heard of The Horse Whisperer, or of Jane Goodall's remarkable rapport with great apes. But you may not have heard of James Howard Williams, Elephant Bill, the Elephant Whisperer, who developed an astoundingly close relationship with the elephants he worked with in what was then Burma, who, in World War II, collaborated with those elephants in carrying supplies and building bridges behind enemy lines and helping the Allies win that war. This hour, On Point, the amazing story of Elephant Bill. Joining me now in our studio is Vicki Constantine Croak. She reports on animals and wildlife for WBUR's The Wildlife blog. Author of The Lady and the Panda, her new book is Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Vicki Croak, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John.
First of all, this is a love story, isn't it? Between this man who landed in the jungle during the 1920s, very difficult living conditions for anyone, but not only got accustomed to those conditions, but learned an amount that is very rare, I would think, in human experience about how to relate to a set of animals.
That's absolutely right. He had always been an animal lover. He grew up in Cornwall in England, and he loved animals. He became so attached to his pets, more so maybe than his family in some cases, that when he went away to boarding school, it was the animals that he really missed. And in World War I, he also worked in the Camel Corps. But after World War I, he had an interest in coming to Burma. He heard about a logging job from an army buddy. And what really tied the what really made him want to do that is the elephants. So he had not met elephants previously, but he'd always loved elephants. When he got to Burma, it was his whole life changed, and he felt something mystical in their presence.
Let me step back from Elephant Bill for a second and talk about you, because I'm interested in how journalists find their subjects. And so, two-part question for you. First is, how did you become a journalist writing about animals? Why is that your beat, your subject? And how did you get to this story of Elephant Bill?
I think that the subject found me. I mean, I was just came out of the womb wanting to pet everything I could. My entire career, John, has been an excuse to pet as many animals as possible.
Lots of pets in your house growing up?
My mother was afraid of dogs. And to her chagrin, I mean, she just wanted to keep animals out of the house as much as possible, but it wasn't possible to do that. I've always loved them. In fact, I thought I would be Jane Goodall. I read her works when I was 13. And I think that luckily for me, in a way, I was sick with lupus as a teenager. I could not become a field biologist. My doctors, in fact, told me I'd never get to Africa, which turned out not to be true. But I decided to be a writer, and I'm really thankful that that's the road I took, because I've been able to cover all kinds of animals, from pets to hyenas to elephants, and that's my passion. This story, I wrote The Lady and the Panda, came out in 2005, and I thought for sure, as I did my book tour, that someone would come out of the woodwork and tell me some remarkable undiscovered story about a relative and animals. And it took a little longer, but I was home one day having lunch. A little elephant book arrived in the mail, and there was a tiny illustration of an elephant up on a cliff. And the caption just said, J.H. Williams saving refugees with his elephants in Burma in 1943. And I thought, that's a story.
Was that a photograph of after that remarkable climb that you describe at the end of your book?
It was an illustration, and it was based on, it was another artist who did it. But as I did this book, I found Williams's own, he was quite an accomplished artist himself, and he drew his own illustration of that scene of climbing up a cliff. So it's a strange thing to see an elephant with a person on him way up on a cliff face and with a big valley below.
The this is a new story for those of us in our time, but I was very interested to read that he became quite well known in his time. War correspondents wrote about him. There were books written about him. Talk about, at one point, this was a fairly famous guy, correct?
He was, and he was discovered mainly, plenty of news organizations covered him, the war correspondents who came to Burma. And Burma in World War II was a horrible place to be, as well as the enemy. People were facing disease and the terrain and the weather. And so I think for them, not only was this an unusual and fascinating story that there was a man in the joining the Allied forces who had a fleet of elephants, but he also was fun, and people enjoyed covering him. So he got a lot of coverage during World War II. But after the war, it really was the New Yorker here in the United States that gave him his start. E.J. Kahn wrote a story about him for the New Yorker, and J.H. Williams had already written a rough memoir. But then he was discovered by publishers, and he wrote Elephant Bill. That was his own book. Became a big success, a bestseller, and he went on to write four more memoirs about his time in Burma with animals.
So how did you figure out what you could add to this story, given what had already been written?
From the start, I thought what I could add was modern knowledge about elephant behavior. Everything that he discovered and wrote about at that time was unproven by scientists. There was no field of ethology at the time that he was there. At least I thought I had that to offer. I was hoping to find information that wasn't available. And in fact, I found his son, Treve, who is a international racehorse vet living in Tasmania. And I contacted Treve. And the funny thing is that I was never quite sure how much archival material he had. It seemed to shift every time I spoke to him. And so I just had to get on a plane and go to Tasmania to find out. The first day that I got there, he presented me with a small suitcase of material. It wasn't great. I wasn't overwhelmed by it, but I thought, well, at least I'll have what is available. That night we had dinner together and a couple of scotches. And the next morning when I arrived at his house, there was a trunk set out with massive amounts of material. So basically, the important thing for me was the elephant biology and behavior, to add modern thought to that and rediscover what Elephant Bill already discovered. And then secondly, there was a lot of information that never appeared in his books. And funny, a lot of that came from, he was a British man who didn't talk about his feelings very much. In his private writing, he did. That was never published. And in screenplays and movie treatments, he seemed more free to talk about what he was feeling.
Well, you talked about modern 21st century knowledge of elephant behavior. Let me get you to expand on that a little bit. What is unique or different about elephants, their capacities to interact with humans, that is different from dogs, cats, any number of other creatures?
What we found is we know that the great apes are capable of incredible intelligence. They're very much like us. And it's always interesting if there are a couple of other species, including dolphins and elephants, that also have these big brains that seem to be thoughtful, and that they seem to, and I say seem because this is what biologists are saying today. To me, it's very obvious that they have emotions the way that we do. And some of the tests that prove that thinking about their intelligence is, for instance, very few animals besides humans recognize themselves in a mirror. And there's the way that you find that out is that when you put a dot of something that doesn't smell like anything on their faces and then you show them in a mirror. If the animal then touches particularly that dot, you know, obviously they realize it's on their face and they're touching in that spot.
Wow.
Elephants can do that. We also know that they have very complex...
Are they unique in that way? Are there other animals who can do
that? The great
that?
Apes, most of the great apes can do it, mm-hmm. And humans. And actually, there's one bird species that's been shown to do that also. I feel like every time we set a line in the sand that differentiates us from other animals, it gets crossed by some species. And so another one is tool use. If animals can use tools and even fashion tools to use them the way they want, elephants can also do that. They scratch their backs with twigs and they may modify them or grab another one that's longer to reach an area. That's a pretty simple tool. But they also, what we love about them is that they have very complex societies. And it takes a big brain to negotiate your way in a society. Remember, who's who, what your relationship is to them. And you, and if you're friends with A, you need to know if A is friends with B and how you stand with them. So elephants also are highly social. They have that complicated world. And we now are acknowledging that elephants probably do have a sense of death and that they acknowledge it, that they can help one another. If an elephant is sick, they'll feed one another. Two elephants on their own may get side by side with an elephant and try to pick them up. So we have witnessed, modern scientists have witnessed that, them behaving in ways where they seem to understand the state of another. They know when someone they love is sick and they try to help them.
Was that known when Elephant Bill was in the jungles of Burma?
No, it was not generally known, but he witnessed it and he wrote about it, all of those things.
So in essence, he was on the frontier of discovery himself.
Absolutely. And he was not shy about saying what he saw. And I also admire the way he was skeptical. He wasn't just a sentimentalist who wanted to believe that elephants were more than they were. He always has wanted to understand animals, he said, from their eyes and see the world through their eyes. And this is what he did. And I mean, one of the really amazing stories from him that matches modern ethologists is one elephant who was very sick and he used to treat them. He treated one elephant for 3 weeks who had been wounded by a tiger. And when he came back to visit her weeks later, she still had an abscess. And the reason he knew that is she had run over to him and shown him her back. She sat down on her haunches, which elephants don't do. He thought that was odd behavior.
No, you told that story in the book of the elephant lowering himself so that he could be examined.
Right. And Elephant Bill's reaction to that I thought was really lovely. When he examined her later, he felt that. But he thought, I don't know what she was thinking, but I know what she was feeling.
Vicky, we just went over that not only are elephants the largest animals in the world, they're also near the top of the intellectual food chain of animals. Talk about before the war, what Elephant Bill did with animals as part of the teak industry.
One of the most important things to me in writing this book was, in order to get to World War II and what he did, we had to see how he built up this incredible relationship with the elephants. At the time that he went to Burma in 1920, elephant knowledge and medicine was primitive. Western books about their care, for instance, always included allspice and roasted onions and brandy for the treatment of upset tummy or flatulence. They had really little to go on. These elephants,
I should say, it sounded like some of the human treatments were also a little rudimentary, involving mixes of tea and whiskey and that sort of thing.
Exactly. That's right. So when he got to Burma, he had books about the treatment, the medical treatment of elephants, but I don't think that they were of much help. We didn't know much about their behavior. And so he was open to it all. He was 23 years old. He loved animals. He got sent into the forest. His boss, there were many bosses at the time who were paternal. He happened to get one who was not, who was a very stern taskmaster. And Jim Williams, Bill Williams is, by the way, I go back and forth with his name because his family called him Jim and his colleagues called him
Bill. I'm glad
Bill.
You clarified that because I kept going back and forth in the book and there was Billy and there was Jim and there was Elephant Bill. And
I have a hard time. If I knew him today, I'm not sure what I would call him. But he decided to learn about elephants on his own. And his boss, the first day that Bill met elephants, seven elephants were paraded into camp, and he's fascinated. I mean, here are these incredible creatures, their size, their intelligence. He really felt that he saw some mischief in their eyes. And his boss said to him, the four elephants on the left are yours, and God help you if you can't take care of them. He thought, well, how do you take care of an elephant? But he learned. He had to learn the Burmese language on his own, and he learned how to take care of the elephants.
He also, as part of that, you told a story which was a little shocking when you first read it, but he killed an elephant in order to try to understand their biology.
What happened with his first set of elephants when we went into the forest, he was given among those four an elderly female, and she was suffering from all the things that elderly people suffer from. She probably had cataracts and arthritis, and she should not have been on the job anymore. And she died during his first weeks. And he did a necropsy or animal autopsy on her and learned a lot from cutting her open, which is not an easy thing to do with an elephant. He later shot a couple of elephants for scientific, quote, scientific interest. Of course, late in life, he said to himself, I cannot believe I could have ever raised a gun to one of these animals, and I today consider it nothing short of murder. So it was shocking for me to read that initially. His change in attitude happened within a year. He never shot another one.
What exactly did the elephants do to harvest the timber and get it to the river to be shipped out?
It's an important question. So Burma is shaped like a kite. It's about 1,000 miles long, and the teak industry was the number one industry there. And he worked for the number one British teak company at the time. And they have camps. Teak doesn't grow in like orange groves. It's scattered throughout a forest, and it was tightly regulated by the government, the colonial government, and they would mark trees that could be harvested. So what men like J.H. Williams did is they ran 7 to 10 camps where the logging was done. They did not do the logging themselves. And in those logging camps, the wood was cut down. It was girdled first. They had to dry the wood out as it was standing, then cut it down. And then the elephants would drag the logs to basically dry creeks because of the weather there and wait for the monsoon to hit. When the monsoon hit, the logs would be picked up and sent downriver. And they'd go to bigger and bigger rivers until they arrived, sometimes decades later, in the mills in Rangoon, the capital.
I'll get back to his story in a moment, but we've got Melissa on the line from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Melissa, welcome to the show, and what's your question for Vicki?
Hi, John. Thank you so much for taking my call. I do love your program. I have a kind of a question comment. I was watching a random Animal Planet show one day, and it had a group of elephants drinking at some kind of water hole, and one of the babies had fallen in. There was a thick mud and was having a really hard time getting out. And all of these elephants kind of rallied together. You know, all the moms kind of came together and tried to pull the baby out as a group. And I'm wondering, you know, if a mother perishes, do the other mother elephants take over and make sure that baby survives? That was kind of my first question.
Hey, Melissa. You know, what's interesting is that all of those observations from the wild, Elephant Bill saw in Burma, and he has one of his best stories, is very similar. And I've just described how in the logging camps, they brought logs to dry creeks, which would then fill up very quickly in monsoon. One of his favorite elephants, a female named Ma Shui, her baby was trapped in one of the, to call it a creek, was a wide river. It was raging with water and filling up quickly. And the logs, these teak logs, which are 2 tons, come down. You cannot be in the water at the time that the logs are coming down. And a mother lost her baby in that creek. And there's a wonderful story that J.H. Williams told about what her enormous courage and how clever she was in finding a way to take her baby out of a riverbed that had shale sides that were sheer. She did manage to raise her baby up overnight. It was hours and hours. The men were trying to help, and they were realizing that they were only botching it. And this female was able to save her baby. It's well documented in the wild that they understand the suffering of those around them and how to, if they can, to alleviate it. In the rare instances when a baby is orphaned, there have been recorded instances where they are adopted by others.
Okay, so let's get back to Elephant Bill. Talk about how his mission, what he was doing in the jungles of Burma, changed once war broke out and once it became clear that Burma was going to be involved in that war.
He knew early on that Burma would be involved, even though many of his countrymen thought that it would be left out of the war. And he also felt deeply that the elephants could contribute. I've described a little bit of the terrain in Burma. It's mountainous, lots of rivers. There was very little infrastructure. There were mostly trails and not roads. If an army was going to move across the country, it would take help. And he knew that his elephants could not only move those forces across this rough terrain where they needed to be, but importantly, that they could build bridges. They could build these homespun, what he called elephant bridges, and that could help troops and jeeps and even tanks get to where they needed to go. He wasn't believed by the higher-ups for a while. He was made a lieutenant colonel, and he also was named elephant advisor, although at the time they had no elephants because Burma had been taken over by the Japanese at that point.
It seemed at times in the book that he was almost beyond the control of the chain of command. He was his own force.
He was a bit of a renegade in life. He never liked authority in his own life, and he didn't like it in the army, which was full of authority and following what he felt. He never followed commands that he thought didn't make any sense. He, in fact, there was a quinine shortage during the war, and people were suffering terribly, the soldiers, from malaria, and he always snuck some in and gave it to the soldiers. But it was the bridges that he knew he had to build for them. So he was able to come back in the country. He was a member of Force 136. They were kind of the dirty tricks division. And so he was his own army. Two of his colleagues from earlier, he made his irregular army. And one by one, he brought elephants back into the fold. When he was behind enemy lines and before the British forces came back into Burma, he was there and he was living through monsoon, which was unlivable to most of the soldiers. And one by one, as he brought the elephants in, he eventually had at his high point more than 1,600 elephants in elephant company.
It was remarkable, as you described, the ways in which the elephants, on the one hand, they were allowed to roam free at times, go out, feed themselves, and they would come back. Other times, they had to be controlled in a fairly severe way, especially when the males were in the, I'm not sure I get the pronunciation right, is it must?
Must.
It is must. Talk about that and how dangerous elephants were in that condition and how they coped with that danger.
Must is this phenomenal hormonal state that males come into about once a year, both Asian and African elephants. And they're basically drunk on testosterone. Their testosterone levels go 50 to 100 times normal. I mean, I think in my own mind, after reading so much about it, that it's almost like taking angel dust or some other kind of mind-altering drug. It had been known about in Asian elephants for thousands of years. It's mentioned in the ancient text, and it talks about odor and wrath and passion love that they experienced during that time. It's not always completely understood, but during that time, even smaller elephants, other male elephants fear them because they are fearless when they're in that state. And they are given mating rights to females because they're so belligerent during. Now you have we have logging elephants, and to the loggers, the worst thing possible is to go into a state of must because they can't work during that time. They would chain the elephants up, and by starving them, the period of must, how often it came and how long it lasted, often had to do with the condition of the elephant. So if you chain them up and you barely fed them, they would come out of must more quickly. They were treated like prisoners during that time.
But didn't you say at one point in the book that if you subjected them to especially hard exertion, that would dissipate some of the forces that were sort of surging in their body?
Yes. Withholding food or making them work really hard could get rid of it quickly. One African elephant, by the way, was in must for an astonishing 6 months. And during that time, it's tough to be in must. I mean, you're dribbling urine. You have your temporal glands are secreting. You're not really interested in food because you're interested in fighting and mating. And that elephant, who was in must for 6 months, lost 1,000 pounds and was in very poor condition when he came out of it.
How much do mature elephants weigh in the first place?
Our Asian elephants, which we're interested in this book, can weigh as much as the big males would be, like 11,000 pounds would be a very big male. We do have an Asian elephant here in the United States at the zoo in Portland, Oregon, Packy, who's he's probably 10 and a half feet tall, and he's weighed as much as 14,000 pounds.
Asian elephants are larger than African elephants?
They're smaller.
Smaller.
The Africans are they're much larger even. They are maybe they can be 4 feet taller than the Asian elephants and weigh much more. But that one elephant we have here in the States is kind of an outlier. In Burma in particular, the elephants were kind of small. Females were probably something like 7 or 8 feet at the shoulder and 8,000 pounds.
Tell our listeners a little bit about Bandula, who was the star, the LeBron James of Elephant Bill's herd.
I love Bandula. I challenge anyone not to fall in love with Bandula. And I almost think of him as the human twin of J.H. Williams. He was a massive tusker, extremely intelligent. He was...
Tusker is a male.
A tusker is a male. So that's another thing. In Asian elephants, only some of the males have tusks. For African elephants, it's males and females. So it's a big difference in that way. This tusker, he was so handsome. He was beautiful inside and out. You just can't help but fall in love with Bandula. He was probably more than 9 feet at the shoulder and something like 11,000 pounds. Magnificent physically. He had, there are connoisseurs of elephants in Burma. And what they saw in him is that he had lavender skin that became almost black when he was wet. And he had pink freckling across his trunk and cheeks and onto his ears. And best of all, he had this rakish aspect because his tusks went up and out. And they would define tusk sets in various ways in Burma. And he had swigar, which is the tusks of a Burmese dancing woman. His tusks were like the arms of a dancer. Here was this elephant who was a turning point in the care of elephants in Burma because he had been raised by a master mahout named Potok, who had the idea early on to raise
mahout
an elephant.
Mahout is a term for
elephant handler. Mm-hmm. And in Burma, in fact, they're called uzis. So if I use that term later, too. And Potok thought to himself that the best elephants for logging would be raised from the time they're young to work and to be around human beings. That was not the way it was done. These elephants were caught in the wild in their teen years and really broken in horrifying ways, beaten and burned and left out in the sun and starved.
Which Elephant Bill set out to stop.
When he learned about that, and he learned about it by examining an elephant at one of his camps, he saw these large, ropey scars around his ankles, and he was horrified by them and said, what accident was he in? And he was told about kadaring. That was the process for thousands of years of capturing elephants. He said, I have to put a stop to this. He wanted more humane treatment of elephants, but he knew if he was going to sell the idea to his bosses, he had to prove that it would make financial sense. So that's what he said about doing. He said to himself, we have baby elephants born in the camps, and they're dying. The mortality rate is so high because the females were forced to continue working and not care for their babies. And he thought, we're letting these babies die, and then we're paying elephant wranglers to bring elephants to us at a high, high cost to the company. And so he worked out the numbers, and he proved that by raising the babies in the logging camps, it would be less expensive for the logging company.
Talking about care, you have a very touching story of a moment when Bandula ingests a bunch of dry rice, later drinks water, swells up in his stomach, he's afflicted on the ground, and other elephants are trying to lift him up and assist him. Talk about that.
Elephant Bill had read in some newspaper a story of African elephants in the wild who will get on either side of an ill elephant and try to raise him or her up. And so when he learned that Bandula—
sliding their tusks under his abdomen.
That's right. They can even snap off a tusk when they try to use their tusks as a bulldozer to lift them up. And he thought, I'm going to try this. So he took two of his biggest elephants and had them get on either side of Bandula. First of all, it was really painful for Elephant Bill to even see Bandula down. Elephants rarely get down on the ground because of the way their lungs are built. And he brought these elephants to either side of him to try to get him up. And they were able to almost flip him over to get him back on his feet. And then Bandula roared in discomfort. But Elephant Bill felt assured by that he wanted to live still, and that the two other tuskers got him up on his feet, and Elephant Bill went to work doing a little plumbing work on his backside.
That was successful. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation. Paula Kahumbu joins us from Nairobi, a longtime conservationist and big voice on African elephants. She's the CEO of the conservation group Wildlife Direct. Paula Kahumbu, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
I want to start by playing some audio. During an interview with KTN Kenya last month, a Kenyan wildlife conservationist wept in front of the carcass of the beloved 45-year-old African elephant Satao, who was killed by poachers for his massive ivory tusks.
Very painful. We need the government to do something. We want to improve this thing. We want to conserve.
Paula, I spent some time in Africa in the 1980s and in Kenya specifically. And at that time, there was a major push on to try to curb the poaching that was decimating the elephant population. Was that completely unsuccessful? Has it been in part successful? What is the status of the poaching threat right now?
John, the ban that took place in the 1980s was very successful. In fact, African elephant numbers began to recover after that international ban on ivory trade was imposed. But in 2008, countries around the world agreed to an experimental sale of ivory to China. And that is what has basically triggered a phenomenal demand for ivory in China that is far outstrips the possible supply of ivory from Africa. And as a result, the price of ivory has increased by 300% in the last 3 years. And it is that profitability that is now being, it's driving the massacre of elephants in Africa. We're losing more than 20,000 elephants per year.
Well, Paula, is there, if the renewed threat can be traced to that 2008 agreement, is there talk of rescinding it?
Well, it's too late to rescind it. The ivory was sold. It came from four African countries, from Southern Africa. The ivory is now held by the Chinese government, and it's released. It was about 60 tons. It's released in 5-ton amounts per year. So what they're doing is drip feeding the ivory into their own market. The Chinese government owns the ivory factories. They are then sending out the ivory carvings into the retail market. For every one piece of legal ivory that comes out of those factories, 10 pieces of illegal ivory accompany them in the retail stores. The Chinese government cannot control it. I think it is one of the most irresponsible things I've ever seen any country do. The demand for ivory in China alone threatens the world's African elephants.
Was that not contemplated when that arrangement was struck?
Of course it was. It was contemplated by many countries. But as usual, with all these political decisions that are taken, and there's a lot of uncertainty, normally what happens is the precautionary principle is invoked, which means that you don't do something if you're really not sure that it's not going to cause a massive threat. So these measures were put in place to prevent any further sales of ivory should it go out of control. Well, it's too late. It's gone completely out of control. And China still defends ivory carving as a traditional right. They call it their intangible cultural right to carve ivory. They're promoting ivory carving in their universities. And as I said, they own the factories. They aren't willing, or they haven't been willing to discuss this. Africa is unable to prevent the poaching. So a lot of attention is focused on how do you reduce demand by talking to Chinese people. Well, there's only one person who could talk to Chinese people and make the difference. That is the Chinese premier and the Chinese government.
Wow. So, Vicky Croak, demand from one country threatens the elephant population of the world?
And actually, it's not even unusual. What happened, the United States drove the market for ivory in the 1950s when there was a demand for piano keys. And piano keys were made of ivory, and suddenly the middle class could afford piano lessons and pianos for their children. And so there was a time in which we were responsible in driving the slaughter of elephants in Africa.
That's very true.
I want to go to one of our callers. We've got Haley on the line from Norfolk, Virginia. Haley, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say I'm super excited that y'all are talking about this topic. Any press about elephants is good press. So I'm extremely happy about this book, and I can't wait to read it, and I'm happy about this show. Most people are naturally drawn to elephants, but it's important about how we go about seeing them, I think, as tourists. We're in great danger of losing elephants in the wild. There's a 2-year gestation period, which is, again, twice as long as human gestation. It's very impressive. So it's very difficult to repopulate the world of elephants. We really need to be careful about how we go about wanting to pay homage to them. Elephants should not be in cities for tourist pleasure. I see that a lot in Bangkok, for example. We're not being helpful by paying to feed them. It's very important that we not ride them. Over the past 14 years, I've gone from wanting to ride them to realizing that that's not okay. As you stated, the domestication process kills over half the elephants that go through it. It's extremely cruel and breaks their spirit, obviously. There are a few places that actually show elephants respectfully. There's a place in north of Chiang Mai, Thailand, where Lek is doing some wonderful work, excellent success story, where you can just go and be with the elephants that are rescued. And I would say that a lot of those places are not what they say they are. Anytime you ride them or watch them paint or do tricks, that's not the type of place that we should be paying homage to. But again, we're all naturally drawn to elephants. We want to be with them any way we can, but I think it's very important that we're careful about how we go about doing that.
Haley, thanks for your call. Paula Kahumbu, how concerned are you about the adverse consequences for elephants from not poachers, but ordinary tourists who want to see and enjoy elephants?
So what happens in Africa, there are very few places where you could do the kind of things you do with Asian elephants. In Africa, the main problem that we have is people who come to hunt elephants. So hunting, which is considered, you know, a leisure activity, does result in very large temples. These are the key genetic resources for the big tuskers. So that's a problem. And the corruption around hunting is a big problem. But the problem that I see, and that we're trying to address as Wildlife Direct and the Hands Off Our Elephants campaign, is that visitors come to Africa and they see ivory trinkets in the markets. And they somehow don't connect those ivory trinkets with the massacre of elephants. And they buy these, you know, gaudy jewelry, little ivory carvings, and they try and go back to Europe or back to the West, back to China with these artifacts. And most in Kenya, we have sniffer dogs. Well, this year alone, we've already arrested 25 people bringing ivory out of Africa just in the form of trinkets. The law is so severe now that you could end up in jail for life just for having a pair of earrings. So my concern is that tourists are inadvertently picking up these ivory trinkets, thinking that they're just cute little items, when in fact what they're doing by buying the ivory is driving the slaughter of elephants, but they're also risking life imprisonment.
Vicky Croak, what about the contribution of circuses, zoos to concerns about how elephants are treated?
Glad we have another hour, John. It's so complicated, and everyone has a different opinion about whether zoos are saving animals or not. Elephants are obviously safe there, but is that everyone would rather see them in the wild or make sure there's always a wild population. And interestingly, all of my conservationist friends, I'm hearing them speak in a militant fashion now. Alan Rabinowitz, who's a big cat expert of the world, has talked about a counterterrorism campaign to keep animals safe from poachers. And hearing Paula speak like that, this really is, we're at a crisis point with all wild animals.
I want to go to another call. We've got Don on the line from Wayland, Massachusetts. Don, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. How are you? My question is, does the elephant need to be killed for its ivory? Not that this is an answer to what's going on, but like, couldn't they knock the elephant out and take its ivory? Would it die just from the ivory? And I had another point, too, I wanted to make. But...
Well, go ahead with your other point, and then we'll take you can listen offline.
Oh, yeah. The other point would be, you know, they have these devices that I've seen that, you know, you can put on, you know, elephants to know whether or not they go down at certain times of the day on, you know, the level of if they're killed. And couldn't they use those devices and make a perimeter around to catch the poachers once the elephant goes down, and then try to make some kind of 10-mile perimeter to come in and catch the poachers using, like, electronic devices?
Don, thanks so much for your call. Paula, what about the use of tracking technology to protect from poachers, A, and B, do in fact elephants have to be killed in order for people to get their ivory?
Thank you very much for those two questions. They're really important. The Chinese believe that elephants' tusks fall out of their faces and then they grow back, and then all you have to do is wander across the savannah and pick up all this ivory. Of course, it's not true. Elephant ivory, they're basically their incisors. And in order to extract the incisors, you have to kill the elephant and then cut off half of its face, because about a meter of that tusk is inside its skull. And this is why you see such horribly mutilated elephants when they kill them. So unfortunately, yes, they have to die in order to get the ivory. In some places, they do trim the tusks. In Asia, for example, some elephants' tusks are trimmed. But if you're after ivory, which is worth over $2,000 per kilogram, you're not going to take a little bit of the tusk. You're going to take the entire thing. This is driven by international criminal cartels. They're not interested in saving elephants or elephant welfare. When it comes to the tracking, this is really interesting. We have many elephants in Kenya with radio tracking devices on them, and this hasn't stopped the poachers. The poachers are a part of very, very intelligent cartels. And we have, in Kenya alone, we have about 30,000 elephants. You simply couldn't put tracking devices on all those animals. Even darting an elephant in order to put a tracking device on it is a dangerous activity for the elephant itself. A number of them will die just in that process. Across Africa, we have about 300,000 elephants. Many of them live in very dense forests. So it's a great idea using technology, but using it on the elephants themselves would only work if you targeted particular elephants. For example, in Kenya, we have 12 big tuskers. These are the giants, you know, the sataus of the world. There are only 12 left in Kenya and probably in the world. So putting tracking devices on those individuals would make a lot of sense, yes. But usually what it means is you're catching poachers after they've killed the elephants. What we've got to do is stop them from getting to the elephants in the first place.
All right, I want to let our listeners get a sense of what these amazing animals sound like. Paula was just talking about African elephants. Elephant Bill worked with Asian elephants, and we have a recording from March 1999 in Nepal by animal recordist Linda McCauley of the sound of the Asian elephant. So, Vicky Croak, should we assume that Bandula sounded something like that?
He had that in his repertoire. And elephants have a wide range of vocalizations, including sounds that we cannot hear ourselves. They're too low in frequency for human beings to hear. And so they can actually communicate along long distances, miles. And this explains, by the way, their infrasound that they use. Researchers, particularly in Africa, who would be in a plane, would see elephants far away from one another seem to coordinate their movements and laugh about elephant ESP. And the elephant ESP turned out to be that sound that we cannot hear, but they can. And otherwise, they have squeaks and roars and rumbles, and they are very expressive vocally. It's lovely.
Vicky, before we run out of time, I want to get you to describe two things for our listeners. One of them is that dramatic scaling of the cliff that Bandula and other elephants and Elephant Bill engaged in near the end of the war, and then talk about the end for Bandula, which was heartbreaking.
One of the real climax, I think, in the story of Elephant Bill's life, and interesting, William Slim, who was the most beloved general of World War II, looked at what Elephant Bill had done in the war, and particularly in scaling that cliff face, and said no other human being could have pulled this off because of the decades previously working with elephants and building up the trust. What happened is that Elephant Bill had when the war really came to a climax for Burma, just outside Burma, actually in India, in Imphal, that was the largest battle to save Burma. And Elephant Bill was ordered to move his elephants just outside the range of the biggest battles. And what he had to do was take the elephants from Burma into India, crossing five mountain ranges, enormous. And in addition to that, he was saving 64 refugees that he was saddled with on his trip. They, during their trip to India, made it over mountain after mountain, and they came to a cliff face that was 270 feet high and just went on in either direction. And they had two choices. Either you teach an elephant how to climb a cliff, or you go back into the hands of the Japanese because they were surrounded. And going back into the hands of the Japanese just was not a possibility. And so they found one spot that the local villagers showed them that they could clamber up and out of, but could an elephant do it? And they ended up, the stone was soft enough to carve some steps into it. And they carved, using existing architecture of the cliff, a stairway from the bottom of the cliff to the top. And they decided to try to bring the elephants, at the time they had 53 altogether, some of them were young, to the top of the mountain. and amazing.
And they did. They all made it.
They did it, led by Bandula and the confidence of Bandula.
Very quickly, talk about the end for Bandula, which I imagine made Elephant Bill weep the way that wildlife worker did in Kenya at Satao.
It was one of the biggest tragedies of Elephant Bill's life, that toward the end of the war, Bandula was shot and killed, perhaps by his own loving master Mahout, for complicated reasons.
Paula Kahumbu, thank you for joining us. Paula is CEO of the conservation group Wildlife Direct. And Vicky Croak, thanks so much to you.
Thank you, John.
Vicky Constantine Croak is author of Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animal who helped him save lives in World War II. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, from The Princess Bride to My Dinner with Andre and a master builder, actor and writer, Wallace Shawn. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.